today. Okay. Today is August 14th, and we're starting a brief mini-series called The Art of Biblical Narrative. It's the name of a book, actually, by Robert Bolter, and it's a title of a course that I give at YU, and you're actually getting the syllabus, so enjoy. Okay. I even have homework assignments at the end.
Wow.
Do we have to pay?
Okay. Okay, everybody. So, the course goal is to study the approach of the Bible in telling stories to the interpretations of Chazal, medieval and modern commentaries, analysis of biblical stylistics, prose and poetry, irony and trends. Okay. Enough introductions. Rashi didn't introduce his commentary to the Torah, and we'll just find out what we're doing as we're doing it. Okay, so the first thing when you tell a story is to choose your words. What we want to become as a result of these few weeks we have together, and full disclosure, next Monday night I have a wedding out of town, so we'll be 2 weeks from tonight is our next class. So what we'd like to become through this class is the following: to be close readers, to be careful readers, as if though we're looking with a magnifying glass. Anybody ever hear of a philosophical concept called Occam's razor? Occam's razor.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, really? Okay. Occam was a philosopher who believed that we should analyze every word that comes out of your conversant's mouth for any extraneous points, because we should always speak as little as possible, and if we speak more than we need to, then I'm going to analyze what you're saying. Right? So if the Torah tells me two words when it could have said the same thing with one word, I'm going to pull that apart. That type of approach to biblical parshanut is Rashi's approach. It's the most famous one made by him because he's the most famous of the commentaries. Did he become most famous because that was his approach? Could be. His grandson, Rashbam, thought not a lot of that kind of approach. He thought that what should be your preferred approach is pshat. Pshat is, forget about the extraneous words. What does the person mean? What is the simple meaning of what the person is saying? Don't analyze every little thing, right? Remember the famous joke, Rashi's wife comes out with a new dress, and he says, you know, honey, I think it's a little too flamboyant. And she says, must you comment on everything? So Rashi does comment on everything, almost. Okay, so I'm going to give some exercises here. We're going to be doing easy stories. Most of these stories you know already. They're simple biblical events, mostly Bereishis. Let's start with word choice A. Okay, Bereishis Yud Chet and Yud Tet. Chapter 18 and 19. It says word choice, just look at the A. Everyone see it at the top of the page on the left side? Okay. So there are two stories in these two chapters where what we all know, these are angels who come to visit Avraham. He's sitting in front of his tent. In the previous story, he had just circumcised himself. He's probably in some degree of pain, right? These three perfect strangers appear to him in the distance, right? And he runs out to them, probably a painful thing for him, right? He runs out to them in order to bring them in for a bite, for some comfort, maybe some shade and some water. The reader, of course, also knows that he does this in the middle of a communion with God, with chutzpah. Any other nation where a person does this, that God will smite him and strike him down, right? In their own writings, of course. There are no other gods, but in the writings of that nation, I'll teach that person a lesson. Don't you turn God your back on God. Don't you turn your back on God while he's talking to you. Okay, but here's the point. Here's the word choice. In chapter 18, when these men come to Avraham, there are three of them, right? One tells him he's about to have a baby with Sarah. One tells him what's going to happen to Sodom. And one, our sages tell us, came to cure Avraham of his recent pain from the circumcision. Okay? Michael, Gavriel, Raphael. All right. Here's the difference. When they go to Lot immediately following this story, right? There are only two of them. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that's okay. That you, Rashi and Rashbam both have to deal with. Mm-hmm. You can't argue that there's two here and there's three there. Why? Why does one go leave? Right? Which one left? The one to say that Sarah will give birth. He's totally not needed. The one who came to cure Abraham is there to save Lot. They're both saving, right? The one who came is going to destroy Sodom went to actually do it. So here there's three, here there's two. This is not a flight, that's clear. Right? The thing that we are supposed to notice is something. Now, I don't want you to take anything I'm going to say here tonight for granted. If you want to challenge me, we'll go open the Chumash and we'll see. But this is very tested. I've been giving this course for 28 years. When these people go to Abraham, they are called Anoshim. They're only called men. They don't do anything that distinguishes them from men. Right? Mm-hmm. In fact, I saw a very interesting paper of Chizkuni who says that the reason why Sarah laughed when she heard what they said is because...
They look like men?
No, every time someone came to Avram's tent, they left saying, "Ah, by this time next year, you're going to have a baby." Like everybody says today. People come to my office and I give them some stucco. They say, "Your children will be happy. They'll get you good shidduchim." So I said, "Listen, are you a Navi? Just change one word. Don't say my children will. Say they should. Right? They ought to. Right? Okay. So Sarah was used to people getting some food from her husband and leaving with a nice bracha that Sarah will have a baby by next year. Right? Okay. So these are called men. But when they go to Lot, throughout the whole story, they're called Malachim. So, on the face of it, there are two stages. I mean, this is a softball. There are two stages to Parshanut. The first stage is noticing that there's something to notice. Right? Dogs always bite a man. I want where a man is biting a dog. Right? In other words, is there something to notice here? And the second stage is, okay, now that you notice this, what are we doing with it? Okay, this is a softball. The reason why they're called a Noshim by Avraham is because they look and acted like men. Avraham thought till the time he said goodbye to them that they were men. Right? Rashi says this. Well, how do we know that he thought they were men? He gave them food. He wouldn't have fed them if he thought they were angels. And there's another story in the Bible where someone feeds angels, and it says he gave them food because he didn't know they were angels. Where's that?
I'm fighting
the man's wife for the prophet, the judge,
yes,
the long hair.
Shimshon. Yes, exactly. Good, right on the ball. It says he offered them food because he didn't know they were angels. All right? So Avram thinks they're men, but when they go to Lot, these two men establish immediately that they're not men. Come on, immediately they blind the men who are coming at the door, and it's immediate. So the reader is told immediately that they're malochim. Simple. Let's go to another exercise. Chapter 24, Avraham sends a messenger to find a wife for his son Yitzchak. Right? Although we tend in our circles to refer to this person by a name, Eliezer, right? You always do. Your Rebbe always did, right? When you learned it in third grade or whatever. But he's never named in the whole story. Okay, the reason why we say it's Eliezer is because in the beginning of the story it says, Zakan Beiso, Moshel B'chol Asher Lo, the head of his household, and that's how he himself is described earlier in chapter 14. All right, fair enough. But here's the point. In the first 14 or 15 psukim where he is referred to, because he's not called by his name, so what are you going to call this guy?
Eved Avraham.
Eved Avraham. Right? By the way, that's how Ibn Ezra used to sign his name. I'm sorry, Rabbeinu Tam used to sign his name in his letters to Ibn Ezra. He said, Hareini Eved Avraham, because he felt that he was subservient to him in grammatical messages. But anyway, so Eliezer is Eved Avraham, but he's not called by his name. So it constantly refers to him, Vayomer HaEved, Vayikacha Eved, Vayavoha Eved, Vayorot HaEved. About 10 times. He's never called by name. Now, at one point in the story, the author changes the reference from Eved to Ish. He's no longer called an Eved. Now, if you were to start to get into this close reading, at what point in the story would you start to refer to him as an ish? And no longer a messenger? In the middle of the story, that's where I might expect it. But somewhere right in the middle of the story, he's an ish. Because at some point in the story, he was no longer acting as a messenger of Abraham. He does something the Talmud is not so happy with, actually.
You're saying, give me the girl and I will walk. If not, I will leave. If you want to give
him. He makes up a kind of deal with God. Yeah. That yeah. Who gave me the right to say the first girl who comes and gives my camp? What if someone not appropriate, not suitable for Yitzchak would do such a thing? How are you so sure that that's going to work? Right? But it did work. It was a smart deal. It shows that she's careful, that she's considerate. Probably a lot of water you have to serve to camels also, right? She's not only considerate to humans, she's considerate to animals. It was a good test, right? So at that point, he's no longer the servant of Avram. Avram did tell him, by the way, God will send you an angel before you, and he'll make you successful. So he felt, you know what? That gives me, I feel good about that. Avram told me I'm going to be successful. He's going to send me an angel. So I'm going to come up with my own initiative. So he's no longer Avram's servant. Now he's Ish. Okay? On this, I take a tangent from something that's not on this page. You're familiar with a parable that a prophet tells David in order for David to judge himself over what he did with Bathsheba, right? Mm-hmm. He tells a parable about a passerby who comes to a rich man's house. You familiar with the story? The background of the story is that there are two men in your kingdom, my king. One is very wealthy and has thousands of sheep, and one is so poor, he just has one little sheep that he bought with his own money, and he goes through a little too much detail, gets a little creepy about how close this sheep is to him. If you want to look it up, you can. Please, we're not going to go there right now. But it says it's a little too far. It says he sleeps with him, he eats with him at the table, he drinks from his cup, and he's a little too close. But by the way, it's important because when you read the story, it's mashma that Uriah and Bathsheba don't have a good marriage. Right? Because when the king tells a man who hasn't been home for months to go home and have some comfort with your wife, and he doesn't go home, why don't you go home? Right? Whenever I get to this point, I always, I get teary and I say, if I don't see my wife for a few hours, I want to go home and see her, we'll go for a walk. Right? 6 months you haven't seen your wife, and the king tells you to go home and you don't go home? Right? But you know what? Here's the morality of the Torah. Adultery is wrong, no matter what the situation is at home with the woman. Alright? So the Torah doesn't tell, the Bible doesn't tell us what kind of marriage they had. It just, we have to hint. But in the parable, this man loves that one sheep very much. To the point of creepiness, really. But this man loves that sheep. So the rich man gets here's where the story comes back. A halech. What's a halech in Hebrew?
Passerby.
Comes to the rich man's house, and he refuses to take one of his many sheep to serve him. Instead, he takes the one sheep of the poor. He says he doesn't want to take any of the sheep to give to the, now he's the oreach, the guest who came to his house. Rather, he took the one lone sheep of the poor man, right? And by the way, the prophet, if he really wanted to make the parable fit the story, he should have said, and then the rich man killed that poor man, right? Because that's what happened, he had the husband killed, right? So, but he didn't, because then that would have ruined the whole surprise. He wants David to cast judgment on this guy, right?
Wasn't or is that after the story?
Okay, but he's still the rich man, who's David, is responsible for the death of the poor man after taking the poor man's sheep. You with me? All right. Now everyone knows who these parables are. The guest, of course, is, I think we discussed this one time
Yitzhara.
Before. The guest is the Yitzhara, the evil inclination that made David, when he saw Bathsheba bathing, right? And so the Yitzhara starts off as a passerby. King is allowed to walk on his patio, and he sees a woman who shouldn't have been looking at. She shouldn't have been there to be noticed. But whoa, I'm going away. I'm going to go here. I got some wives inside there, and I'm finished. But instead, he allowed himself to become not a Helech, but an Oreach. He allowed the Yetzer Hara to stay in before punching it away from his head, and it became a guest. And then, before punching away a guest, it became now our Ish. So I'm claiming to you that the close reader of the Bible will never miss these things. Why is this saying? This is all one verse in Shmuel Bet in chapter 12. So it's Helech, Oreach, Ish. First find out, what is this defining? And then work on, why is it changing the word? Yes, question.
And the scripture says, well, it starts off by saying it came to pass at the time that the kings go to war. So was it wrong that King David didn't go to war? Was he...
Okay,
where
that's...
he shouldn't have been, even though it was his right to be there in the palace?
I'll tell you that David usually went to war, so... And he was taking naps in the afternoon. It says he got up from his nap and he walked along. What? The people are at battle and you're taking... Anyone in the Bible who takes a nap in the afternoon, it does not work well. No, seriously. Three kings take a nap in the afternoon. Ishbosheth gets assassinated while he's taking a nap. Eglon gets also killed by Ehud while taking a nap. And here. So it doesn't work well. Anyway, what the rabbis did notice is that from that time to this very day, this is the justification of some sorts of how David stayed married to her after the story, right? Is that because the people were in battle, men from then to this day, still in Israel in battle, men give their wives conditional divorce documents when they go to battle in case they are taken prisoner or in case they are lost and their wives are stuck. Right? In American law, she would have to wait 7 years. There's no such clause in Jewish law.
She'd
have to wait till something is found about her husband. So if the man, the divorce document said, if I don't return within a certain reasonable amount of time, 2 years, 4 years, whatever it is, after this war is over, after the war is declared over, then you're free to remarry. It's as if though I divorced you from now. So if that's the case, Bathsheba was technically not a married woman at the time, and David's real sin was that he sent him away and secretly had him sent away to die. Yes.
I think that I found a fault with Uriah, in addition to what we regularly say, because I was just thinking, let's say that David HaMelech committed adultery with Bathsheba, or allegedly, that perhaps Uriah at that point should have distanced himself. Like, let's say if he would have run away, he would have been out of the picture completely, then at that time that he wouldn't have been killed. Because sometimes, in real life itself, like...
No, I must cut you off. Okay. No one could expect a man to do that. No, nothing. The halacha doesn't expect him to, and nothing else should. What Uriah should have done was just go home, because the king told you to. You listen to the king. I have no way to prove what I'm about to say, but every logical point of the story indicates that had Uriah gone home the first night, or even the second night, David would have washed his hands clean of the whole thing. Bathsheba would have given birth to a child some months later. Everyone would have said, well, hasn't her husband been away at war all these months? Oh, no, he was there at home. He had a furlough. Okay. And hopefully he wouldn't be redhead, but all right. I'm just saying is that David would have wiped his hands of this. But David gives them a subject, a command. You have to listen to the command. I'm sorry. It's simple as that. All right? Okay. Let's go on, please. So the next story is Bereishis Perek Lamed Ches. Yes, well, Yehuda is mourning the loss of his wife, right? He has already lost two children, right? He's suffered a lot, right? Whether this is before Mechiras Yosef, after Mechiras Yosef, no, let's not get into that now. But he sees a woman along the road. The all-knowing author of Sefer Bereishis, all known because the author of Sefer Bereishis knows what people are thinking. Right? Yeah. Gemara says, how do we know that Esther was written with prophecy? Because there's a pasuk in the book that says, Haman said to himself, who is the king thinking except me? How could anyone know that if the book isn't written in prophecy? Alright? Okay, anyway. Point is that when Yehuda is on the road, what does the Bible say about what he saw that day?
Zona?
Talk to me here. Zona, it says.
Okay.
He thought she was a Zona. Right? When he asks for what he gave her, typical hire for a Zona, he says to the Canaanite friend of his, Where was the Kadesha that was here just recently? I want to pay back. Right?
So now it's just a Kadesha.
Now, I must tell you, for a Hebrew, Kadesha and Zona are the same. Kadesha may even be worse than the Zona. Right? They both do the same work, they both probably get the same payment, but the Kadesha is like a cult prostitute. She does it for, she says a bracha. Right, she's well. She's called Kadesha. Right, she gives her. She gives. She tithes the money she makes to the temple. What does the Torah tell us about the hire for a harlot? Lord, right, you can never take a esnan zona because that's what they were doing.
Yes,
with their Kadesha money. You got it. Mm-hmm. Following. So, because when he's talking to the Canaanite, he doesn't want to say where is the zona that I was with. Was there a zona here in town? Because throughout history, Zona has always been taboo, right?
So
you don't zona is taboo. You know, you don't admit to your friend that you went to a zona, but you can admit to a friend that you went to a kadesha. Men made their daughters kadeshas all over the ancient Near East. As far as the Torah is concerned, kadesha and zona are the same. Kadesha may be even worse than the zona. But he's not talking to another Hebrew. He's talking to a Canaanite here. So he tells you, changes the word zona to kadesha. You with me on this? Okay. All we're doing is we're nitpicking words here. Okay, the E is a little, I'm really nitpicking here, but remember there's a story in Sefer Melachim where because Shlomo charged such confiscatory taxation, the Israelites went to his son and they said to Rechavam, if you lighten up on us, we'll continue to serve you. But if not, we're going to rebel. We already have someone who we're going to appoint. Right? So it says that Rechavam took advice from two groups of people. Remember who they are? I mean, I wrote it down here. He said he went to the Zakenim, the elders. A king has elders, right? Maybe even older than he is. And it says, and remember, he's already 41 years old. He became king at the age of 41. So he went to the elders and they said, listen, you better listen to them. Your father did burden the people too much. Lighten up. All right, go easy for a couple of years. Then maybe you'll increase the taxes again. But you got to lighten up, right? So who'd they go for the other advice?
Yeah.
That would be crazy. He's 41 years old, and it says he went to the Yilodim for advice. So what I want to just the point of all of these exercises now is, first of all, you can't do this if you're reading in English. Usually, you have to really read the original Hebrew to get all this right. But two is, don't just be a disinterested reader of the text. You've got to read carefully and closely. Why would a king ask Yeladim for advice? So it says these were the kids he grew up with. They were probably his age. They were in their 40s. You don't call someone in their 40s not a Yeled. The reason why the Bible calls them a Yeled is because they gave childish advice. Hmm. He followed it and they rebelled. And that's why we had two kingdoms. Okay. When Yaakov prepares a gift for his brother in Parshas Vayishlach, can you tell me what it's called?
It's
a mincha. Torah says he prepared it, and he uses the word 6 or 7 times. A mincha for his brother. But when he actually gives it to him, the Bible calls it kach no es birchosi asheru baslach. When he actually gives him this gift, the Bible calls it a bracha. What do you think the Bible is telling us about what Yaakov is doing there?
Hearkening
back to the source of their dispute back in Parshas Toldos, where he filched a bracha, right? And while we're on that topic, I'm supposed to have a wife. There it is. Okay. While we're on that topic, do you remember when Yaakov falls in love with a younger sister? Remember her name? Right? Rachel? So he tells his future father-in-law, I'm in love with your daughter as Rochel Bitcha Achtan, right? Whenever you want to be specific. Alright, I don't want to be interested in this board. I don't see a marker, so we'll look. Alright, so he asks to marry Rochel Bitcha Achtan. Rochel, your younger daughter. Right? But when the switcheroo is made later, right, after the Bible referred to them as a ketana and gedola over and over again 5 or 6 times, but when Yaakov confronts his father-in-law with the same word the Bible uses, b'mirma lamari misani, right? Mm-hmm. What is Lavan's line? Lo yasekein b'mkomeinu, in our place, like in your place, we don't put the younger before the older. But it doesn't use lo yasekein b'mkomeinu lo seis ha-ketan alifnei ha-gedola, like the Bible had been used to. But it purposely changes the words to se'ir alifnei ha-bechira, to hearken again back to this story. So, well, seir and bechira also means younger and older, but it just harkens back to the word bechor. It's very pointed, not the little one and the big one, but it points to a bechora, which is the Yaakov's.
Who are you confronting me, you hypocrite? Right. Yourself.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, but it's part of Yaakov's atonement, which is necessary throughout this story. And the greatness of the conflict that's created by these stories is that our great sages learn from this, grow from it, and we have similar conflicts. All right, now let's go to something more interesting. Trends and patterns. You know that there are three people who meet at a well and meet in the Torah and get married. In fact, in the whole Bible. Yeah. Only three. You're only told how three people meet in the Bible. I guess David met Bathsheba. It was also something with water. But okay, but I'm not counting that. It's where Yitzchak is set up with Rivka. He doesn't actually meet her at the well, but it's all the whole story happens at the well. Shlucho Shaladim Kimosa, right? And Rachel and Yaakov. And Moshe and Sipor. I purposely use this example is because in Robert Alter's introduction to his book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, he uses this particular example to underscore the following point, and I would like to maybe together come up with another example of this of what's happening here. He says that if there were seven examples in the Torah of people who meet, and three were at a well, and two were at a water fountain, and one was at the Shalashur this year, and one, so then okay, I don't know what to do. But if all the times that people meet is at a well, at a be'er, so there has to be a message here. So there are famous messages. There are three types of water sources in the Tanakh. One is a bore, one is a be'er, and one is a there's a bore that a man makes by himself, right? It's like a cistern. If a man didn't make it, it would never get there, right? A spring gets there all by itself, right? A well starts with something God put under there, and man was involved. So it shows that when you want to make a good shidduch, you have to have a sense that there's God behind it, and Hishtadlo has sent some help from a person. That's why all the people who meet are meet at wells. Don't leave it only up to God, right? That would be a spring. Don't leave it only up to man. That would be a cistern. But leave it up to both man and God. Okay, all these kind of beautifulness. Wonderful. What Alter does is he says that look at the role played by the woman in these three wells. That will be indicative of her role not only for the rest of her life, but how she is perceived for the rest of Jewish history. Who were the three women? Rivka, Rachel, Zipporah. Who plays the most significant role at the well in these three stories? Rivka. Rivka has the greatest effect on Jewish history, perhaps more than any other woman in the Bible, by switching Yaakov and Esav. Right? For better or worse, I'm not going to discuss that now, but there's no greater role played by a woman in the Torah than this. Now, Rachel, what role does she play? You know, she died relatively young, but she is accessed by a Navi later. We're going to read about it on Rosh Hashanah, and that's quite significant. Yirmiyahu says that we returned from the exile in the merit of Rachel, for goodness sakes. That's amazing. Won't get into now why, what did Rachel do to deserve such a thing? It's this beautiful midrashim about that. But the one who really plays no role, to the extent of which Zipporah is simply not mentioned again outside of Sefer Shmos. Even in Bamidbar, where they mention Aaron's family and Aaron's wife, in Divrei Hayamim, no, nothing, as if though she doesn't exist. Because she played no role at the well. How do I know? Because when she came home,
he said, why didn't you,
come on, he said, how did you get home so early? Right? And she said that this Egyptian man helped. Come on, you left him there? All right? So Robert Alter does this, he ingeniously does this in all kinds of trends in the Torah. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to put my hand to this. So I'm going to give you the trend, you tell me the three points. So usually it's three, and it's always a nice small number that can make a trend. There are three stories of Moshe upon his emergence from the palace to see his brethren. All three stories involve some type of conflict. He sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, mm-hmm. possibly to death, I don't know. It just says he's beating him. It's important for us to know if he's beating him to death because Moshe's about to kill the beater, right? Mm-hmm. All right, but he was probably so incensed of seeing this. This is what goes on here in Egypt all the time? Why isn't someone doing something? Vayarki Einish, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He saw no mensch, no person to stand up, right? It doesn't say Vayarki Ein Roeh, no one's looking. It says Vayarki Ein Ish, no Egyptian, no Hebrew, no one's standing up for this poor guy. He's about to be killed, right? So that's the first. Second conflict, he sees two Hebrews fighting amongst themselves. And then he sees two non-Hebrews fighting, right? The shepherds and these girls, mm-hmm. right? So basically what you have here in these three stories is every possible combination of his people and not his people, right? Egyptian, Hebrew, 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 non-Hebrew, non-Hebrew, right? And right after these three stories, God appears to him in the burning bush and says, "You're my man." And Moshe says, "Who am I?" So the reader might also say, you know, God, when you told Noah to build an ark, at least you described him. You said he's a great tzaddik, he's a righteous man, he's going to save the world. But with Moses, we're not told a single description of him except these three stories, right? So that's the answer, is that God wanted someone who would stick his neck out for something right. It's everyone else is saying, tis, tis, what they're doing to the Jews. Look at that poor guy. He's going to kill him. Oh, what a shame. But here's someone who stands up and does something. Now, it could be that he did so because he had the gumption to do so, he had the chutzpah to do so because he's raised in the palace. Right? The other poor Jews are beaten into such submission there in Egypt that they didn't even know how to stand up for someone else. Right? Anyway, there are three stories here. If you would say he was, of the three stories, which one did not have a successful ending? Because the first one, what's his objective?
Save
the life. Did he? Yes. Did he go overboard? I'll leave that for some midrashim later. There is a midrash that God tells Moshe he went overboard. Two. He's two Hebrews fighting, right? You can have a picture in Chazal the way Aaron would have dealt with this, right? You ever hear of it? What would Aaron do to these two guys?
He'd
make them fall and make them love each other. Oh, he'd go to each one separately and say, "Oh, if you only knew how upset he is that you're fighting, oh my goodness." And he'd go to the other, and before you know it, they're all hunky-dory, right? That's Shalom. Shalom can lie. It would be a lie to go to each one separately mm-hmm. and say that, right? Because they're not really saying that. It's a Mishnah Novos Dribinasan that Aaron did this. But Moshe's emes. Moshe just reacts at the moment and he says, "V'yomer l'rosh shalom atakereyecha," and they don't react well to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And he flees.
So on this one did not work out so well for him. Right? The third one apparently did work pretty well. Gets a wife out of the deal. Right? Okay, it worked out, I'd say, pretty well, right? So now, let's see if someone can do to these three stories what Robert Alter did with the three wells. What is being foreshadowed here in these three stories?
That he cares no matter what.
No question, he cares no matter what. But what does it mean that in the middle story he had trouble?
Our worst problem is Jews fighting with Jews.
Yes,
always.
There's no doubt that that's going to be the message in as part of the story throughout our history. But what does it mean to Moshe? You see, at first God doesn't tell him that he's getting any help from someone else. It's only because Moshe pushes off God three or four times. They go and say, "Okay, Moshe, enough already. Your brother Aaron is going to help you do this." I can see you don't feel, but I know Aaron had already been told to start making his way to Moshe, so he's on his way already.
His reaction to Jews fighting with Jews or Jews complaining to him is going to be his downfall.
Right. Sefer Bamidbar. Moshe, if faces any threat to his people, whether it's caused by their own stubbornness or their own sinfulness or whatever it is, Moshe knows how to deal with it. He stands up to God for his people, right? But a few times, right? He stands up to anything. He stands up to whatever it is. The people mean so much to him, even in the face of all the terrible things they've been doing to him, right? So when it comes to saving them, he's there. But when it comes to dealing with the internal strife, like Korach, and oh goodness, and the Meraglim, he needs help. He needs help, so that's why he needs an Aaron, right? So the second story does not work so well. If Aaron had been with him there, things might have been different. And the third story, when it comes to dealing, you see, that story may tell the most about Moshe. He sees these shepherds, I don't know who they are. In the movie, I think they're Amalekites in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. They're pushing away these hapless shepherds, and Moshe should say to himself, "Come on, Moshe, I know you want to get involved, but it's because you can't stay out of people's business that you're here in the first place. Well, stay out of their business. Let them deal with it. Do I know why those shepherds, or maybe those girls did something? I don't know. Stay out of the business." That's not Moshe. That didn't even enter his mind for a second. What he does is he sees someone weak, someone being abused, someone taking advantage, and I'm going to step in. He doesn't even give it thought. What does this mean that I'm getting involved now in the third conflict in 20 Pesukim? Right? So that doesn't enter his mind. So in that might represent like how he deals with Sichon and Og and you know wherever he has outside of the nation he has dealings. He'll succeed there too. So he succeeds in number one and number three, but in number two, he should have, you know, when you saw those two people fighting, maybe that wasn't the approach to take right away.
Yeah, could you tell so quickly who's
in
Russia?
The one hitting. So that's what Robert Alter does with this Wells, and that's what I think we can do with this. And it's perfectly legitimate to read the Bible this way. Or I think perhaps the most common trend in Sefer Bereishis, or in the whole Torah, is sibling rivalries, mm-hmm. especially where the younger brother outsmarts, outdoes, or is more successful than his older sibling. And older siblings don't take kindly to this, right? I think Winston Churchill, a younger sibling himself, wrote a book chronicling the kings of England and mm-hmm. all their siblings. Right, there has never been a king of England that was an only child, and he shows that in every instance, by his estimation, the younger sibling would have made a better king. Right? Because when you're born first and you just can't wait to be king, right? You don't do anything about it. You just become king, and you haven't succeeded in bettering yourself. But your two or three younger brothers, they have to work hard at being the number two. Hmm. Right after the oldest one, you can go skip to number four for the second in command. Right, so that's an important lesson in competition or in that kind of an approach. Anyway, the first story of the Torah teaches us of sibling rival teaches us the great dangers of unbridled competition. Hmm. Surely God could have told Cain some kind of message that would have kept him from killing his brother. Right? Instead, God just gave him a nice pep talk about trying harder. Because this is a competitive world, Cain. I'm not just going to give you a free ride and give you a cloud that I gave your brother, I don't know, whatever. The Bible doesn't even tell us how Hevel knew that he got something and Cain didn't get whatever, right? Yisha means. God respected Hevel's, but not Cain's. But there's a great, terrible story of the competitive spirit and what it achieves in that story. Competition makes great products, right? It brings mm-hmm. out the best in products, but it brings out the worst in people, right? But we do need competition to put out good things. You have to feel I'm working harder and I'm going to be rewarded for working harder. So the Torah protects us. It forces us to tithe, to leave our land fallow, to not charge interest, to create a sense of magnanimity that Allah, what we call in Hebrew, vatranut, so that I don't take my competitive spirit too far. All right. So we see that there's great conflict in sibling rivalry, but whenever you read biblical narrative, don't leave your story until you have resolution of the conflict. Right? The Bible does not ever tell you a conflict without resolution. If you didn't read the resolution, you didn't read enough. Okay? It may not be in that story itself. You may have to wait until you get to Ephraim and Manasseh or the end of the Yosef. But I'm not sure if Yosef and his brothers have full resolution. Two reasons. The words "I'm sorry" never appear. The words "I forgive you" never appear. Mm-hmm. Two, when Yaakov dies, the brothers think that Yosef will kill them. That doesn't sound like resolution. Right? Three, the Meshech Chochmah says in Parshas, it's in Parshas Vayeshev, that the reason why we read about the 10 martyrs on Yom Kippur is because we still have to, in every generation, atone for the sale of Yosef. It doesn't look like resolution, right? So the resolution is not between Yosef and his brothers. The resolution is between Yosef's children, Ephraim and Manasseh. Yaakov pushes, you know, he crosses over his hands, right? He puts his right hand on the younger one. And there only Yosef complains, implying that the older one did not complain. So Manasseh saves Sefer Bereishis. Let's give him his due. Ephraim becomes the king of the northern tribes. But if Manasseh, right, you get Gideon, who else, you know, Slavcha. There's some good Manasseh stuff, right? It's a nice movie named Manasseh out now. But the point is, because of that resolution, who are the next two brothers in the Torah? So Moshe and Aaron, beautiful, beautiful. Who's the one who gets to be greater? The younger one. And this time, the older one is happy. Your brother is coming to meet you, and he's happy for you. And it's so beautiful the way Rashi creates all of Moshe's apprehension. Look at all the Rashis. He says, "But God, what about Aaron? God, what is Aaron going to say?" But it's good. Moshe, Aaron's happy for you. Stop with the Aaron. All right? It's just so beautiful. Because of that, Aaron, because he's happy, he deserves to have descendants like Aaron Katz.
This is under the heading of trends and patterns. Statistics teaches us that one observation has zero generalization, and two observations doesn't set a trend.
Okay, that's why we're always looking for three. Yes?
Do you think Aaron being happy for Moshe is the reason that he's not censured or punished by the eagle?
I think he is punished by the eagle. Rashi says he lost two sons because of that.
But it's a postponed punishment. You know, some mental paragraphs, if he didn't have that, he would have been punished.
Last week's parasha you read about, Hashem Hisanach Ba'aron. So in the story, however, we don't see that. In the story, Aaron gets to say whatever he wants, and it's not questioned, and it's, you know, what did they do to you to make this thing? And he goes, well, you know, they're stiff-necked people. Yeah. I'm sure Moshe had an answer to that, you know. Why didn't you stand up to them and say, "Over my dead body"? And he says, "That's what Chor did, the nephew." And then they killed him. So would kill me too? So that's Aaron. That's why Aaron is so great. He knows that's what shalom means. I'll say shalom. He knows how to bend him, compromise him. I'm willing to be the bad guy in this story, but I can't let them kill a Navi and a Kohen. You know, the famous the God of Tehillim. Yes?
I have a question about something you say in the beginning about with Abraham and the angels and Lot.
Yes.
That they were not angels, but that they were men. Yes.
No, the first three were also angels, but they looked angels. Like men.
But they okay.
And they behaved like men.
Because I know that there's different orders of angels, and the lowest order are the ones that come like human beings.
Yes. So there's a beautiful point, though, is that, I mean, after all, what is an angel? An angel is someone who's a messenger of God. Who told Joseph where his brothers were? And you know, Rashi says it was an angel. Ibn Ezra says it was just a person. So you can be an angel. Just be a messenger of God. Get out there and do God's work, and you're an angel. So I have one more before we break.
Yes, we don't see any actual speech of forgiveness between Yosef and brothers, but they do speak Divrei Shalom.
Okay, they do speak about understanding. Yosef says, "I understand what happened. I explain what happened. This was part of God's work. This is all I understand." That's what we call sapiential literature, where homo sapien. that where we understand, where it's wisdom literature. I understand all the vicissitudes of life, and at the end it all comes down and we're explaining. But that doesn't, still doesn't mean that I'm, because had he outright forgiven them and made it clear that he forgave them, they wouldn't have said after Yaakov dies, I think Yosef is going to want to kill us now. They wouldn't say that. I want to close with one thing. Okay. And I'm going to skip the appearance of goats in the time's attention. I mean, if there's a moment for that. When Avraham confronts his barrenness, God, you keep promising great nation. What great nation? I don't have any children. Okay, now God could have told him, well, you know, George Washington is called the father of his nation, and he didn't have any children, so don't worry, you won't have children, but they'll still call you the father of the nation. Someone else will have the children, you'll be the father. No, God doesn't tell him that. He says, Avraham, you will have a child. All right? Now that's in response to Avraham saying, Anochi holeich ariri. God, I have no children. So what's going to happen to me? So God says, no, Avraham, you will have children. Don't say you don't have children. You will have children. What story comes just a few psukim right after God tells him this?
Hagar.
Sarah tells Avraham, listen, Avraham, God told you you're going to be a great nation. He never told you you'd be a great nation with me. I'm willing to give up my place in history. Take this woman. Maybe you'll be a great nation with her. Right? So it's great unselfishness. The story didn't actually turn out so wonderful, but the point is that in the next generation, where Avraham's son confronts his barrenness, the conflict has a beautiful resolution, because Yitzchak is the only one who doesn't confront barrenness by taking another wife or two, right? Vayetar Yitzchok LaShem LeNochach Ishto Ki Akarohi. Right? Avram said, I have no children. I am Ariri. When Yitzchok is praying, he says, I'm not going to make this mistake my father made. Vayetar Yitzchok LaShem LeNochach Ishto Ki Akarohi. I'm praying for her. He didn't pray for himself. I said, I don't have to pray for myself. Hashem told my father, Ki Yitzchok Yikorei LeChozara. I know I will have children. Whether it's when I'm 40, when I'm 140. But I know, I have faith, I will have children. I'm not worried about that. I want it to be with her, not with someone else. So, Vayasa lo Hashem, Vataha Rivka Ishto. And the same Pasuk! Yitzchak had the least problem with barrenness. Avram suffers through quite a bit. It must have been not easy to go to be 100 with Sarah, with a child. Yitzchak, Vayatal, one Pasuk. It's all in one Pasuk. Prays for a child. Doesn't not even his next Pasuk. It's that Pasuk. It's a nice long Pasuk, right? But think, had Avraham said, God, you tell me great nation, what good is it when Sarah and I have no children? What would God have told Avraham had he said that?
She'll have a child.
You will have children.
You in plural, right? You would use the plural. What do you mean, Avraham, don't say you and Sarah don't have children. You and Sarah will have children. So that in three psukim later, when Sarah tells him, Avraham, I'm sorry, this is not working. Take Hagar. Maybe you'll build a nation with her. Right? What would Avraham tell her?
I don't need to do that.
Sarah, I have insider information. I know something. It's not necessary. I don't have to take Hagar to fulfill God's promise. Because he told me it's with you. So imagine, this is how we read Sefer Bereishis. These little tiny differences. The points of these stories are for us to get to glean these resolutions of conflict. Conflict, we have no children, we know we're supposed to have children. If they didn't know that they're going to have children, okay, maybe I'm just not destined to have children. But when God, the deity tells me I'm going to have children and I'm 80 something years old and nothing's going on, right? Plus, you know, at the end of the story, it says he heard from his brother, and he gives all of his brother's children, he has 12 children, he has 140 grandchildren. What's going on here? I'm the great nation. I'm the father of a nation, and I have nothing. Right? And then when he finally gets a child, he's supposed to take him up to a mountain. This one he sends away. What kind of nation is this? Right? So, So this is the conflict. It's because we learned through the Torah stories how to deal with this conflict that we're still here reading about, right? So this is the how we're learning on this. But finally, number C, and then D goes beyond. C is that throughout Sefer Bereishis, in periods of great tension, wherever there's an animal in the story, the animal is a goat.
Hmm.
Right? That's the go-to animal. Right? So the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim says an amazing thing. Because of these stories where Yaakov tricks his father with a goat, the brothers, the worst thing, they kill or slay a goat and they take it, and they drench the blood, the coat and the blood of the goat. Yehuda with the goats with Tamar. So because all these stories involve goats, give me one pasuk that we say about 50 times in the Torah. Okay, that's the Seirizim Echod L'chatos L'Hashem. Right? Does that pasuk sound like it? Is it about 30 of them? By Sukkot 12, you have all these Seirizim Echod L'chatos. The sin offering in the Torah is a goat because of these stories. So, here's my this is my introductory class. We're meeting next time in 2 weeks, please. Next Monday we have a wedding. So please remember this. Become more careful readers of text. This is probably true in Shakespeare too, but it's infinitely more true than anything in the biblical reading. Yes, that's
true. Yeah. With Abraham and his barrenness, what I always find most interesting about that story is that he had the right, according to his culture, when he was in where he was, to take a second wife or a concubine at that time. His barrenness only becomes an issue for him when God appears to him and tells him, you're going to be a father of nations.
Okay,
that's the way
I will tell you this. If you can get your hands on this book, it's called Understanding Genesis by Nachum Sarna.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes through in chapter 16 of Bereishis the various comparable laws that exist at this time in Sumeria, in Egypt, in Babylonia, about, but even while you're married to woman A, about how do you deal with barrenness by taking
wife.
Woman B, and what happens if there's conflict between them. And it seems that the way Avram and Sarah deal with the story, although Ramban is a bit critical of Sarah, is that they're dealing with the story much more kindly than these various laws allow. Because they mostly say you keep the baby and just send the woman away, or give her freedom. But in all the laws, the family keeps the baby. Sarah, that they sent Hagar away back to Egypt, but they said you take your child. It's cruel to keep your child, right? In all understanding, Sarah by that time had her own child, but still, in according to these various laws I just mentioned. The rule is you keep that child. She bore the child for you. It's like a surrogate mother, right? But Sarah is much more kindly disposed. It's cruel to keep her child, to send her away by herself and leave the child behind.
No, she has a reason, because he's playing roughly.
Oh, yes, okay, yeah, and economy. But I understand. Sarah doesn't want this child. But it's very interesting. But if you have a chance to get it, it's called Understanding Genesis. By Nachum Sarna. He goes through these laws.
Do you want us to keep this? Or do you want
it maybe, if you'd like to, by all means. But if you want to keep it here, we'll get just handed out next time. That would be fine.
Yeah.
Next time, we're going to actually go into the nitty-gritty of text inside these pages. Okay? Yes?
When she suggested the doctrine of Abraham, that was the idea that she bore the child and be her.
That's a dispute. Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi writes, "Bonemi mena, for the zchus of doing this such a kind altruistic act, I will deserve to have my own child." Ibn Ezra says, "I will take her child." Ibonemi mena says, "Not from Lashon Binyan, Lashon Ben." Ibonemi mena, I will take her son.
That was accepted in those times.
Yeah, okay.